Welcome to the New Books Network.
From Brandeis University, welcome to Recall This Book, where we assemble scholars and writers from different disciplines to make sense of contemporary issues, problems, and events. I'm John Plotz, a science fiction scholar from the Brandeis English Department. And since our topic today counts as science fact, I'm joined by a very special co-host, Gina Turgiano, brilliant Brandeis neuroscientist. Are there any other kind of Brandeis neuroscientist? And Gina, you always pick the best episodes to host. So listeners may recall her awesome conversation with Madeline Miller about her novel, Circe, way back in February of 2019. And Gina, I'm going to turn over to you for the honor of introducing today's guest.
Great. Thanks, John. Well, it's absolutely wonderful to have Elizabeth Colbert here to continue our conversation about her thought-provoking new book, Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. Elizabeth is a journalist and science writer who's written three books, including the Pulitzer Prize-winning Sixth Extinction, writes extensively for the New Yorker magazine on issues of climate and the environment. And her books are just engaging, thought-provoking, occasionally deeply frightening, and have had a really tremendous impact on my own thinking about human impact on the planet and where we go from here. So Elizabeth, welcome to Recall This Book.
Thanks for having me.
So Elizabeth, we like to begin, if you want to take up the invitation, just by inviting our guests to speak briefly about the book in question, White Sky. It's highlighting, you know, maybe what you think its key questions are or its key conclusions, and then we can go from there.
Well, I mean, the book is about human impacts on the planet in the biggest possible sense, and I hope really brings home how thoroughgoing those are, how ubiquitous those are, and how very serious they are. And what it's really looking at is how do we, you know, we've had this sort of control of nature attitude. It's in all of our engineering, a very gung-ho, you know, man against nature attitude. And now we are realizing, and we're bringing that same attitude, I would guess I would say, to a nature that we ourselves have remade. And what happens then? What happens when we confront this nature that bears all of our own fingerprints, but often does not behave in ways that we like then ultimately, even though in many ways we're responsible for that. And so I wanted to look at the sort of remade world that we have and how we're going to respond to that. You know, you'd have to be a pretty hard-hearted reader, how's that, not to come away feeling implicated, first of all, and feeling that there are a lot of ethical questions that are raised here, both, you know, in the case of the sixth extinction towards other species and potentially in Under White Sky towards other humans. And the fact that one of the complexities, which I do not go into very deeply in either of the books, but which I think that the books both also implicitly raise, is that sometimes our, you know, what we would consider our obligations to other people and what we would consider, you know, the right thing to do vis-a-vis other species, those are not necessarily the same things. Those may be in tension. They may even contradict each other. So that is, you know, that's the situation that we're in. As I say, being a journalist, I don't feel that it's my obligation to offer the answers. Maybe I'll leave that to the academics.
You talked about, you know, growing up, I guess, back in the 70s, you know, that era of a kind of romantic environmentalism, you know, a notion of wilderness, which I mean, I know it goes far, far back beyond the 70s. But for me as a kid in the 70s, I remember these sort of green earth, you know, the posters we made in second and third grade. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, your own arc of thinking about that, you know, from save the wilderness vision to, you know, the sort of environmental, both environmental actions and environmental possibilities you see nowadays.
Yeah. Well, I do. I was, you know, very much influenced as a kid by trips I made out west to the Western U.S., which I now, you know, would realize was already, you know, profoundly, you know, altered landscape. But to me, that was, you know, this was pretty wild and this was pretty amazing. And I guess you'd almost say it was a, you know, it's part spiritual, part aesthetic, part ethical, but, you know, we need to hold on to these places, these landscapes, the everything that depends on these landscapes. And I felt that quite strongly from an early age because of those experiences. I actually grew up in the suburbs of New York where, you know, there wasn't much left alive, you know, and it was, you know, everyone had gone through and, you know, sprayed everything with DDT doubtless. And, you know, that had been banned, but, you know, everyone's garden had no weeds. And that was probably the result of pesticides. You know, we didn't have any, when I look back on it, you know, we didn't have really frogs, you know, around, which there must have been, you know, so everything had just been denuded of life in some way. And that I found really disturbing, even as a kid. Then in my journalistic career, I spent a long time writing about politics, honestly. So I wasn't really thinking about these questions. And when I came to think about them, you know, the world had moved on and there were these huge questions that many, you know, the scientists were grappling with, you know, and they're still grappling with. And, you know, the question of what is the right approach to take, you know, is it to, you know, manipulate things on a whole new level, or is it to try to back off as much as possible, which is something that, you know, we spoke about when I was visiting Brandeis. That is a really, you know, profound question. And Ed Wilson, one of his last books, you know, called Half Earth, and it talks about how we should be setting aside half of the surface of the earth basically for other species to live in. And, you know, that's there's a tremendous number of problems with that. You know, there's a lot of people living in these places that you might want to, you know, quote unquote, set aside. And there are huge pressures on them, the Amazon, you know, the Congo Basin. But that is, you know, Ed Wilson's not stupid. He certainly realized, you know, there's climate change, there's all these things going on. But his point basically was, you want to leave as much space as possible for evolutionary processes to take place, even as the whole world is changing. If you don't leave space for animals to move, species to move around, for these new interactions, you know, you're just going to get this really impoverished ecosystems. So that's another sort of approach. It's a much less interventionist approach on some level, although it's also on some level intensely interventionist. So we are in a situation right now, I would think, and I say this without fear of contradiction, you know, where there are no easy answers. You know, you can't say anything, let's just do this, that would be easy. There's just none of that. Those have all been foreclosed.
And, you know, the other element of this that, you know, you touch on a bit in the book and also in our previous conversation is it's not just coming up with a engineering solution on the part of scientists, it's coming up with the political will to implement. I mean, I was just thinking about the American chestnuts, right? And this is a great story. It was just in the New York Times, but, you know, I've been reading about it for years. Now, the idea of just introducing a gene into the American chestnut that comes from other plants that are already resistant to the blight. It's a simple process of moving this gene into the chestnut, and it actually saves the trees. And of course, this was a huge, you know, fraction of American forests throughout the East, great food source. I mean, just incredibly sort of foundational basis of this rich ecosystem, right? And so, it seems completely obvious that the right thing to do would be to, you know, introduce this tree back into the forests with this simple gene, you know, genetic change. And yet there's incredible resistance to that idea, right? And, you know, it's the fear of unintended consequences. And this is a case, I think, where you could look at it, you know, I would say as a scientist who thinks about these things in a fairly sophisticated way. This seems like a pretty good bet to me. Like, it's not such a, but of course something could go wrong. But then the alternative, as you say, is potentially worse, right? That we're watching, you know, most of the major tree species in the United States dying off from different kinds of blights that we could potentially fix.
Well, I think the chestnut is a really good example. And, you know, I talk about it briefly in the book. And when I actually went and did that piece on Hawaii, that very first piece that sort of got me going on this, I went out at the half a piece about Hawaii and the sort of two thirds of a piece about Hawaii and a third of a piece is about the chestnut. And I went and I talked to those guys out in Syracuse. Bill Powell is really the guy who's responsible for it. And it's kind of was interesting in a, this is also a bit of an aside, but, you know, they worked really, really hard on that. Now with CRISPR, they could have done it in, you know, 5 minutes. Okay. So, but, you know, it's been a 25-year project. They started 25 years ago when the techniques were not nearly as sophisticated. And that is a case, I think that genetic engineering, you know, is a case where unfortunately there's been, and I'm not saying you shouldn't be careful with genetic engineering because Lord knows you should be, but there's just been this weird, you know, there's so many things we're doing to mess up the world. And it's interesting that genetic engineering of certain things has become, I mean, it's just very hard to understand or explain. I mean, the Europeans are not eating, you know, GM corn. We eat it every single moment of every day. They will not accept GM corn that comes from other parts of the world. So other parts of the world are not using it. So it's pretty interesting in how that happened. You know, a history should probably be written about that. And that whole anti-GM, you know, is a really interesting and problematic. I think very problematic. How's that?
Hey, Elizabeth, can I jump in on that? I love that point about the counter example. What would a good counter example be of something that we ought to be as worried about or more worried about than genetic engineering, but in fact has for political reasons or ideological reasons gone under the radar?
Well, you know, you're driving your car is probably worse for the world than this, you know, putting this GM chestnut out there. This and the thing that's almost, you know, I mean, I don't want to trash people on this podcast, but, you know, people say, well, we shouldn't be doing this GM chestnut. We should be crossing the chestnut with the Asian chestnut and then back crossing it. You know how much non-native genetic material is going to be in that chestnut tree? Is going to be way more than is in this. So, like, you know, once again, I'm not a geneticist. I don't want to claim any great knowledge, but unfortunately, there's just a lot of bad thinking going on in that front. And I completely agree with Gina. This does seem pretty close to a no-brainer. It's a gene from wheat. And people have in fact discovered, I believe subsequently, and this is going to be a very interesting turn in the genetics debate, that that gene is actually there. It's just not turned on. Huh. And so with CRISPR, you're going to be able to turn things on that weren't turned on. And then it won't even be GM. And the USDA has already just said that. So you have a lot of plant breeders out there looking for these genes that they can click on and not call the thing GM. And that's going to be huge. Now, do I think that's GM? Do you think that's GM? These are all, you know, interesting philosophical questions. But as far as food products are concerned, that has already, that, you know, cow has already left the barn, as it were.
Yeah.
So, you know, the GM chestnut. Now, the problem we get into with the GM chestnut, I want to say, is, you know, the forest has also moved on. You know, so it's not clear, you know, where are you planting these things? They take 100 years to grow. You know, you're not getting the forest back of the past, and you're not getting the creatures that depended on that chestnut back. I mean, there's probably a bunch of, you know, small things, probably insects, you know, that went extinct when the chestnut tree died out. But I basically agree. I don't see why we wouldn't want that chestnut out in the world. And we're going to keep, as Gina also alluded to, we keep confronting this. Now all our ash trees are dying. Now people have, I believe, looked at trying to genetically modify an ash tree. I think it's very, very hard when it's a predatory insect. It's much easier, you know, what some things might be pretty easy to engineer resistance to, and some things are going to be very, very difficult to engineer resistance to.
Hey, Gina, can I ask you, you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but how would you answer the question I asked Elizabeth? Because I feel like I'd love to know your thoughts about this too. Like, what are other things that we are easily willing to accept that we don't accept with GM? You know, how do you understand the like world of trade-offs?
Well, I mean, I think the example Elizabeth brought up is sort of perfect. Like, we accept all sorts of hybrids that are creating a new organism. And it's unpredictable how that organism will behave. Much more devastating, I think, is that genomes are moving all over the planet all the time. Another point that Elizabeth makes in her book, and this is something that humans have facilitated greatly. I mean, it used to happen anyway, but it took much more time. It was harder for organisms to travel these great distances. Now we're bringing them all over the world on airplanes or shipping them on, you know. So all of that genetic mixing is happening all the time. And it's at such an enormous level that's impacting all of the ecosystems on the planet, right? So I guess a very rational thing, like introducing a gene that is already there, turning it on, whatever, you know, some of these simple modifications are way, way less problematic than the things that are happening constantly, unintentionally, right? And yet, by design, they could have a positive impact if they were done well. And so, like, this just brings up the whole dilemma. This seems like a simple, like, pretty clear answer in the case of maybe the American chestnut or some other things. But then when you start to get to things like injecting particles into the sky to reflect the sun, we're on a whole different level of complexity where the unintended consequences are potentially enormous. I mean, you know, planet devastating, right? And I don't know how you weigh those. I mean, I don't know what precedents we have for that. And I don't think we understand the planetary, you know, ecology and, you know, weather systems and climate systems well enough to really know exactly what those things do. We could look at volcanoes and so on, right? So I don't know. I mean, I think that the great line in your book, Elizabeth, you know, the question of whether, you know, dimming the fucking sun is a better alternative than not doing it is like exactly where we may find ourselves sooner than we thought, you know. So then the question is like, how do you make those calls? Who makes those calls?
Before we pivot to introduce our other two speakers on this podcast, I want to go back to Gina's point about the deeply frightening, because that's definitely been my response to both the books of yours that I've read, which I loved them and they scared the bejesus out of me. So I guess my question for you is like, are you frightened by the things you uncover and report on, or how do you think about it? How do you get through the day without...
Yeah, no, they're very frightening. If you're not frightened about what's going on right now, you're not paying attention. And I think, you know, honestly, what's really frightening, even more frightening than I could have anticipated on some level, was what would happen to, you know, American politics, you know, so that we could have, you know, it's been pretty depressing to cover climate change for quite a while. And we recently had, you know, some good news, the first piece of climate change legislation. So that's good news. I want to applaud that. But, you know, in the interim, we've also had, you know, these crazy conversations around COVID. So if you thought that, you know, we were going to be able to solve or deal with, I shouldn't say solve really, a problem as immense and complicated as climate change, when we can't even, you know, agree on whether we should get vaccinated against a deadly virus, that's, you know, that has made even me, I thought I was pretty inured to things, but I found that very frightening, really, really frightening. I don't know how we can confront problems that are much more ethically and scientifically complicated than COVID, which, you know, was a huge problem, don't get me wrong, but it was a fairly straightforward problem that we understood, you know, a novel pathogen. If we can't even agree, you know, on the most basic things, most basic, public health measures.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Okay, well, on that cheerful note, we're going to make a generational pivot, because I'm delighted to announce today that as part of Recall This Book, we're welcoming two first-year Brandeis students who were winners of a contest open to all the students who were reading, Elizabeth, your book, White Sky, because it was selected as the first-year class read as part of the Helen and Philip Brecher New Student Book Forum. So I'm going to introduce first Hedy Yang, who is from Montgomery, New Jersey, and is interested in pursuing economics and environmental studies at Brandeis. And you might be interested to know she has a 1,032-day streak going on Duolingo. And then I'm also going to
introduce what language, Hedy?
Yeah, that's a good question, Hedy. What, more than one language or just one?
No, just one. I'm actually learning Esperanto, and to be honest, I haven't learned all that much. It's just like doing the lessons every day. But it's like nice to keep the streak going. So,
wow, that's great. Okay,
that is great. And then our second guest host is Needy Sriraman from Arlington, Mass, who plans to study biology, neuroscience, and business at Brandeis University. And her summer reading highlight was Lessons in Chemistry by Bonnie Garmus, which, Needy, I don't know anything about that book, but that sounds cool. And I'm really glad to have both of you. And can we just invite you to take the conversation away?
Yeah, absolutely. About that book, that is an amazing book. So I highly recommend to anybody who wants to read it, who's interested in it. It's a great book. But switching more to a literary side, I'm a big reader. So when I saw that you talked about Frankenstein in your book, my interest was like, oh, I've read that book. And my question to you is, in your book, you mentioned the novel Frankenstein, and you noted about how that cold and gray environment in Europe led to that story. And whenever I think of climate change and the environment, I think of one of my favorite books, The Road by Cormac McCarthy. And he talks about this post-apocalyptic world covered in ash and clouds, and it's gray everywhere. And so I'm wondering how you think our changing environment will change the stories we continue to say in the future. And if you think there's a type of story that will be more prominent, or if there's a new type of story that might emerge.
Well, that's a great question, you know, and people have sort of been, you know, there's this whole genre now that's been named cli-fi, and they tend to be, you know, pretty pretty bleak, you know, sort of post-apocalyptic or even during apocalyptic, you know, stories. And a lot of them, you know, some of them take on climate directly, some maybe more obliquely. But I think that, you know, one of the interesting things, I mean, I guess I would say, I don't think climate change has gotten its sort of great literary treatment yet. I look forward to the great cli-fi novel. How's that? And I think it's a very hard, story because it's such a, it is so ubiquitous and it's so big and sprawling. It's not even like nuclear Armageddon, which is an event, at least you get a, you know, lot of bombs going off. I think increasingly, I guess if I had to say, I think increasingly it's going to suffuse all literature, you know, all contemporary literature is going to increasingly have a climate change element because, you know, we're all, it's going to increasingly affect our daily lives. It's going to be hard to not have that in there. So I'm not a novelist, and I know a lot of people working on different projects of trying to sort of imagine a future for us in a creative way. And I do think that's important that we do that, because I think that, you know, most people aren't reading the latest, you know, science paper. So it is important to have something that people can access through other media.
Yeah, kind of creating possible, even positive visions for where we could go. I think there is.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that it's hard. It's really hard, you know, because it's such a global story, and because to create a positive vision, I can't remember if we discussed this on the Ministry for the Future, is a pretty recent book by Kim Stanley Robinson, sci-fi, cli-fi, definitely.
Yeah.
And it's quite a sprawling book because, you know, basically climate change requires, you know, so much, a huge change in how we live and how we do things and how we think. And he tried to take that on. And I think it's been quite a successful book. But you have to be willing to talk about a lot of pretty heavy duty, he takes some, you know, quantitative easing. I mean, he takes some interesting digressions there that I guess a lot of readers followed him on. I was sort of surprised by that and impressed by that, I have to say, because I wouldn't have necessarily anticipated it.
I actually have a footnote on that, which is that I was in Austria and Czechoslovakia this summer. And in both places, I talked to sort of Eurocrats who mentioned that book. That was the first thing they wanted to talk about.
Oh, really?
So I was also surprised that people were willing to follow him down the quantitative easing rabbit hole. But I think he has a gift for changing scales. You know, there's this guy, Rob Nixon, has this concept of slow violence. Like, I think it's like what you were saying, Elizabeth, things that are invisible in the ordinary apocalyptic timescale, like as you said, like a nuclear bomb, we all know what that means. But these slow processes are harder to conceptualize.
Yeah, I feel like that's really interesting to like think about how almost sometimes you like take for granted the settings that many of the books that we read now take place in, how that's going to be so different in the future. So I guess shifting almost from like a future perspective and what books are going to look like in the future to more of a historical one, I guess my question to you, Elizabeth, now is that I just kind of wanted to hear your thoughts about like environmentalist history. And as you write, like specifically in your book about Rachel Carson in particular, I mean, I'm sure we all know that Carson was very influential in bringing the environmental crisis to light in like the 50s and the 60s with her book Silent Spring. But you also mentioned in your book that, you know, her recommendation of using invasive or like non-native species as pest control had pretty negative effects, as we see through things like the Asian carp. So what would you say about Carson's overall legacy? And are there any other environmentalists who you feel like whose work are especially notable, you know, whether for positive or negative reasons?
Well, I think, you know, Rachel Carson's legacy is, you know, super impressive. Have that. I don't think there's hardly any books where you say, well, that really, you know, changed the course of history. And Silent Spring really did, for reasons that are not, you know, entirely clear. People have a little bit of a hard time figuring out why was that book such a huge hit. And, you know, one theory has it that it was a time when people were waking up to the dangers of nuclear fallout too. So we had all of these, you know, sort of silent, a new generation of things where, you know, you wouldn't see them or smell them or sense them, but they're very dangerous. And that really, I think, resonated with people, you know, already concerned about nuclear fallout. And that was when we were still doing above ground nuclear testing, and people were discovering that every little kid's teeth, you know, had radioactive decay products in them. So it was a monumental book, led to congressional hearings, led to bans on certain pesticides, which, you know, I can say from personal experience, I'm pretty much as old as Silent Spring, exactly. In fact, you know, there are now eagles back in the Berkshires, which there had not been for generations. That is a product of Silent Spring, you know, getting rid of DDT, which was really bad for birds, a lot of birds, in addition to a lot of insects, and a lot of fish. So that's been huge. Now, there's a lot of, you know, there's controversy about it. There is some controversy about it. You know, we don't produce DDT. Some countries still do produce DDT. Has it, you know, led to deaths from malaria that could have been prevented? So it's not a straight, I don't want to say there aren't other impacts that I could have focused on, but from my perspective, it was a largely very, 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 very important and very, very positive book. Now, at the very end of Silent Spring, Rachel Carson advocates this use of biocontrol, right, as an alternative to pesticides and herbicides. And, you know, that was not her, you know, she wasn't the first person to come up with biocontrol. You know, biocontrol had been practiced, was being practiced even at the time. So I don't, you know, I don't kind of blame her, as it were, for these biocontrol efforts gone awry. But I do think it is interesting in a way. I mean, it's pretty interesting that someone who was very keenly sensitive to the ways that we were perturbing the natural world does seem to have had a slight, you know, blind spot to what the potential ramifications were of moving all these predatory insects. That was mainly what she was talking about, around the world. And you know, we've seen, you know, the carp, you could argue, was taking her too literally. but you know, there are lots and lots of examples of things that were brought in to chase around other things that have had very, very damaging impacts.
I think another figure that I also noted a lot in your book was Henry David Thoreau. And so I'm just curious as to why did you take inspiration from him? Because I noticed, like, in three different times you talked about him. And I was also wondering what you think Thoreau represents in the environmental movement.
Well, that's a really good question. These are all really good questions. So Thoreau is sort of I'll call him the father of nature writing in the American tradition. So he is sort of the touchstone, if that makes sense. And so in a purely from a literary standpoint, he just towers, stands over everything, and everyone is in his shadow. And that, you know, in some level includes Rachel Carson, who I'm sure had read Thoreau. And he, you know, wrote a lot. There's always a Thoreau quote you can find, because he's pretty prolific. And he was very, very deeply interested, you know, long before most people were, in what our relationship was to the natural world. Now, in a lot of ways, Thoreau is, of course, you know, very, very dated. You know, he lived not all that far from Brandeis. It was already a very, very, as people point out, you know, when he went out to Walden, it was already a deeply changed, you know, landscape. And it was changing really fast. I mean, that's one of the reasons why he went out to Walden. It was changing so fast. The railroad was coming through, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I've read Thoreau with students. He is not, you know, wildly popular with them anymore. It used to be something you had to do when you went to, you know, college. Basically, you took any class whatsoever on, you know, the American naturalist tradition, you would have to read Thoreau. He's very dense. You know, he's dated. He's from the 1840s. What can I say? He's not politically acceptable in certain ways, although he was very, very ahead of his time in many, many other ways. in many ways, most ways, I would say.
Is there something that you would want, you would tell like every student to read of Thoreau's work right now? Like, is there a certain...
You know, I would read the first couple, like the first 75 pages of Walden. I do think that they still speak to us in the way that we are prisoners of. A lot of it was also, he was rebelling against social conformity, and the way that we are prisoners of our possessions and the way and what people think of us and certain ways of doing things. And I think that that still the language, as I say, is tough. It can be very tough because he writes these, you know, magnificently long sentences. But I think that if people gave it the time, if you have some time to read the first 75 pages of Walden, I would really still recommend it. It's quite amazing writing, and it has a lot to think about it.
I wanted to ask almost like a forward-looking question in a way. I mean, I know at the end of your book, it's meant to convey a sense of like, we don't know what solutions should be taken. There's that sense of like uncertainty and ambiguity. But I kind of did just want to touch upon like almost like an environmental justice side of it in a way, because many of the solutions that you explain in your book, I feel like occur in first world countries or take generally pretty high levels of industrialization or technology that like not all countries have in order to put into place. But I do also recall that you mentioned in your book that countries that contribute less to the crisis, which, you know, are typically less developed countries in the global south, shouldn't be responsible for fixing the crisis. So I guess, what do you think is the role of different countries or like agents in solving the crisis? And should countries be more focused on development or conservation?
Well, you know, this is the great dilemma of our time, I think, or one of the great dilemmas of our time. How's that? And you know, I guess if I were to give you the sort of upbeat answer, I would say, well, there shouldn't be, we shouldn't see a tension between those two things. There should be, you know, there are the sustainable development goals. We should be able to, everyone should have a decent standard of living without, you know, continuing to destroy what's left of the natural environment. You know, unfortunately, I think the reality on the ground is a lot more complicated, as you allude to. And we generally see, you know, in a lot of countries, not all countries, I think some countries really have put sustainability way higher up the, you know, list of priorities than others. But we do often see countries letting sustainability, you know, whenever the economy gets soft and, you know, it really falls to the bottom of the agenda, and all countries, and I'm talking from the US and China to much smaller, you know, poorer countries, crank up the economy at the expense of sustainability. And I, you know, think this, you know, this gets us back to Ministry for the Future, you know, you know, the huge inequities in consumption are completely unsustainable in my view. You know, American levels of consumption are, if universalized around the world, you know, we will have an unlivable planet really, really fast. So we in the US, I think, you know, we need to look at it from both directions, both from, you know, how people around the world can have what we would consider to be a decent standard of living. But we also need to be looking very, very seriously at our own standard of living, which is probably, you know, at the heart of the problem. And we need, you know, people have talked about this idea of convergence, that's vis-a-vis carbon emissions. We should all be emitting the same amount of carbon. We now emit many, many hundreds of times more than many people in different parts of the world. And if you see that as a stand-in for consumption in general, you know, we should be aiming for that. Now, that's a lot easier said by me sitting here in the US in, you know, my own, you know, pretty comfortable house than it is done. And I don't have the mechanism by which we could even do that. But I'm very sympathetic to countries that are trying to bring up the standard of living for their own people. but I do think it is a tragedy if that's going to come at the expense of the Amazon rainforest, of the Congo Basin. Those are just irreplaceable resources. And that, once again, is being said by an American, you know, who lives in New England, where we chop down every tree, you know, that was there and it has since grown back. So we think of New England as kind of a, you know, woody place. But if I'd come, if I were right where I'm sitting right now, 200 years ago, you know, in Thoreau's days, everything would have been cut down.
All right. I have one more question. So I'm curious as to why you chose the title Under a White Sky, because I thought that when I was reading, I feel like that was such a small portion of the book. Like it wasn't the Asian carp or anything of a big topic. So that's my question to you.
Yeah, well, that is a very good question. Naming a book it's not that easy. You know, I thought a lot about what this book should be called. And in fact, the French decided to call it, in the French, it's called The Fish in the Desert. So you could have called it, you know, you could have named it a lot of different things. Nothing seemed to capture the whole book. Maybe it's sort of too many disparate parts shoved into one book. But I liked Under White Sky because it seemed to encompass the whole idea that you're going to live under even the sky. The color of the sky was not going to be the same. So I that was why eventually I went with it. I thought it had a kind of, you know, ominous quality to it, but also kind of unsettling. You don't know exactly what it refers to until you get pretty deep into the book. But that it was capacious enough, how's that, to take in the book. Whereas The Fish in the Desert, which is fine with me, you know, it's sort of like that's really doesn't seem to take in the whole book. But right. I had a really hard time finding a title for it. I thought about it a lot.
But we have a very visceral reaction to the idea of the color of the sky changing. It's such a visible alteration of our environment, whereas so many of the other things that are happening are subtle and slow, and you know, but that really kind of strikes you with a little bit of horror, I guess.
Yes, that was definitely what I was aiming for.
Yeah, I guess maybe the answer about things are only frightening when they're perceptible. So that's part of the value of writing and of wonderful journalism, you know, is to make things perceptible. Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for taking the time for this conversation. And thanks again, Needy and Hetty. I want to thank you for your part in this conversation. It's great to have you. Recall This Book, I should say, is sponsored by Brandeis and by the Mendel Humanities Center. Sound editing is by Naomi Cohen. Website design and social media by Miranda Puri. Elizabeth Perry is a co-founder of the podcast. And today's hosts were Gina Trigiano from Neuroscience. Gina, thank you so much. And me, John Plotz. So Elizabeth Ferry and I are very eager to hear your comments, your criticisms, and your thoughts on today's discussion and on all of the topics that follow from it. So please write a review or rate us on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcast. If you enjoyed today's show, I think I invite you to check out related episodes on our website, recallthisbook.org. So from all of us here at RTB, thank you for listening.